Hello, this is Bixby. Welcome to the Bixby Developers Chat Podcast. Here is your host, Roger Kibbe.
Hello, Bixby Developer Chat listeners. Today, I have the honor of talking with Stephen Arkanovich. Stephen is an accomplished voice developer and very well known for his Big Sky capsule. It's an amazing weather capsule and one that I use every day. Stephen is also a philosophy professor. So it's not every day you get to talk to an esteemed philosophy professor and an esteemed voice developer, and we get to do that today. So Stephen, please introduce yourself.
Yeah. Hi, Roger. Glad to be here. I'm Stephen Arkanovich, as you said. By day, I am a philosophy professor at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. And then by night or on the weekends or whenever I can get it in, I am a software developer for voice platforms, specifically Amazon Alexa and Samsung Bixby.
Great. So Stephen, how did you get started with voice? What's your first experiences with voice?
Well, my first experience with voice, I think like a lot of people, had to do with Alexa and getting one of the first Alexa devices and getting it in the house and being excited about the possibilities. And the first thing that I wanted it to be able to do, actually there are a couple things I wanted it to be able to do that it didn't do in those very early days. The first was actually control the lights. And in the very early days, it didn't control hue lights or it had very limited functionality. And then the other thing is I wanted it to be able to control my music playback in my home for my home stereo. I'm a bit of an audiophile and I have a big collection and I would love to have been able to just ask it to play something and have it play on my stereo. So I actually got in contact with a software developer. I can't remember how, maybe on some chat group about Alexa. And he had figured out in the very early days how to start building what would come to be called skills. And it was a kind of a cool hack. So what you would do, and this is what I did, is you just set up a little web scraper at home, like on a Raspberry Pi, and you would set it to scrape the history section of the Alexa web interface. So every time that you made an utterance, right, that little history section would be updated with what you just said. And then you could just pass that string along, right, to whatever service you wanted to do. And then you can you parse it yourself on the back end, and then you could just send it out to your lights or to the stereo, right? And so I got in contact with him, and he put together a first little capsule or skill to control the stereo. And I thought that was just great. But I also thought he charged too much to do that. And so when I wanted to update it and have more capabilities, I just thought, well, I surely can do this myself. And so I started to learn to code to be able to do that. And that was the very beginning. And I was like an active contributor to this GitHub project, which allowed you really just 6 months out of the gate to schedule things on your Google Calendar and add events to Evernote and control your lights and stereo. So it was a kind of a really cool kind of hacker project just in the very first few months after Alexa was released.
I love it. So you were an early voice hacker with Alexa.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. So you grab the output and with a Raspberry Pi and said, okay, if I hear these words, then turn on the lights or turn off the lights or start my stereo, et cetera.
That's right. You sent whatever the utterance was to your back end. And if it had the interesting words that you wanted, like play or pause, then you could parse the utterance and send it out to the API for the music server, which is what I did.
Awesome. So you were early on doing that, sounded like home automation and then your audiophile, which is kind of ironic, but makes sense. Ironic because now there's so much home automation built into these platforms and music is so well supported.
Yeah.
But they didn't have it originally, but it makes sense then because you actually sat there and said, hey, what is this good for? What's voice for? I want a little bit of home automation. I want to ask it to play X or play something and get it going, which is to this day, I believe the most popular use of voice assistants is playing music, I think is number one. And home automation is somewhere up there in the very top things that you're able to do.
Right. And, you know, it's still the abilities are, well, they're great and expanded, as you said, but they're still limited. So one thing I wanted to do, and now I can do, if you have several different versions of a song or an album, right? If you have a vinyl version and a remastered version and right, a bootleg version, so you could say, play Heart of Gold, and then you would want it to tell you what three versions you have in your library, right? Which is what I really wanted it to do. Because I had a big collection, and that's what it can do for me now. So it'd be great if they could somehow do a little bit even better with, I don't know if this is a metadata problem, but do even better with giving music selections. And when you get to classical music, it's still a bit of a bug. Yeah.
Right. Oh, so you are definitely the audiophile and the music fan if you have multiple versions of song acts, the live version, the studio version. Maybe that's different concerts or that. I love it. I love it. That is a true music fan.
That's right. Yeah. And Alexa was perfect for that. It really was perfect for just say, play the song. Then it just comes right back. Here are your three versions. Which would you like to hear? Right. That is an ideal use case for voice.
So, Stephen, it sounded like you said originally you had this idea and you farmed it out and found a developer to do this work for you. But it was, that's a little costly. I'm a smart guy. I can develop this myself. So tell me how that was in the early days and learning to develop and what you did.
Yeah. So it was kind of a confluence of both fortunate and unfortunate things. So around the time I got an Alexa device, I also tore my Achilles tendon. So I was chair bound for a long time. And I thought I would take that opportunity to look at some online classes because I'm in education and I was just wondering what do these online classes look like. So I took an online philosophy course, which I did very well in, I have to say. And I also I was a little nervous, but it turns out I'm fine. And then I also took an online computer science course, the Harvard CS50 Intro to Computer Science course. I just thought I'm interested in this. So I took those two things, and then the Alexa device came, and it all just sort of like was a great synergy. So I'd taken the computer science course, and then I got this code from the developer who had done the home automation stuff. It was in a different language. It was in Ruby. So, and given that I couldn't really get out of a chair much, I just kind of sat down and just went at it, just practiced and wrote things and read programming books. And in a month or two, I was actually quite proficient.
And was this all in Ruby? And do you still develop in Ruby primarily?
Yeah, I still develop in Ruby primarily. I do some Node, but just because in the early days, all my skills and Big Sky, which is a fairly large undertaking, is all in Ruby. And I think it's the ship has sailed for me to rewrite it in Node or something like that. It's just, it would be too much effort. So.
Right. You know, I think whatever their first programming language is and you get some kind of affinity for it and comfort with it, that kind of never goes away. And what is some of the first voice experiences you built? So you had your home automation and some of the music things. What about yourself that you actually built?
Yeah. So the home automation stuff I built myself. I think there's still some embarrassing YouTube videos out there about me controlling the Hue lights, but I really, because I wanted total control over it. So the Hue integration was you could set timers, you could tell the lights to go on. And now I guess you can do this natively. So there was a really deep integration with the home automation. And then Google. So what's odd is like, this was a fairly difficult thing to do as first projects, like Google Calendar integration, that was one of the very first things I did. And Evernote integration was one of the very first things I did. And then when the Alexa Skills Kit came out and they started publishing skills, I think the first thing I did was a translation program. The translations were fine, but the pronunciation was just abysmal. Just terrible.
Of course.
Right. So I think that was maybe the first published skill I did was something called Alexa Translator.
Got it.
But it must have been one of the first 20 or 30 skills on the marketplace.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's really amazing. I always look back at your first efforts in any platform and kind of cringe with embarrassment, but also say, hey, it was part of my learning process, right?
Yeah.
And so and at that point, everything was like that. Now it's gotten more and more sophisticated. And it makes me always wonder, if we think certain things are sophisticated now, what are they going to look like 5 or 10 years from now, right?
Yes.
Blow our minds away.
Yes, I think that's true.
So tell me about Big Sky, because when I think about it, it's not the most intuitive thing to build at first, right? All the voice platforms have some kind of weather capability built in, which usually works pretty well. What was the motivation behind building Big Sky?
I think the motivation was actually similar to the music server integration, which was that in general, at first, I thought Alexa was too chatty, in a way too conversational for things that were really transactional. So I couldn't get very specific weather information, like would it rain in 3 hours, right? Or what's the low temperature in the next 5 days? Either I couldn't do it, or if I could do it, I'd have to hear the entire weather forecast right before it got to the piece I was interested in. And so I'm not a huge weather geek or anything like that, but it does take a little bit of time to open up the weather app and scroll through the days and then expand that and then look through the hours and then find what the temperature will be like on Thursday at 3 p.m. And I thought this is really a perfect use case for voice. Just ask it the specific question and get back just the answer you wanted. And so I started to build that integration also with my favorite weather app, which was Dark Sky, and it had an API, and their weather data is really great. And so I think that was my motivation, just to be able to get just exactly the weather information I wanted really fast, and it seemed like a perfect use case for voice.
That makes sense. You wanted a specific question. Is it going to rain in 3 hours? Right?
Yeah.
Perfectly reasonable question. When is it going to start raining, et cetera, et cetera? And tell me, you've been working on Big Sky for a while. Tell me about maybe some of the big enhancements that you've done to Big Sky over the years.
Yeah, there's been several and they continue. So at first I really built it for myself. And if I had known it was going to take off, I would have done many things differently from the start. So there's been a number of things that I had to do over the year that were fairly big lifts just because it's a bigger project now. But in terms of its capabilities, I introduced severe weather alerts. This was all on the Alexa platform. And right, and that was quite a difficult thing to do, especially if you're a complete novice and don't know how weather alerts are sent or how they're located or anything, right? So adding severe weather alerts was one thing. Adding custom weather alerts. So just like with many mobile apps now on Big Sky, you can schedule if the weather is going to meet a certain condition right in the next day. So you could say, tell me if it's going to rain tomorrow at 10 a.m. and it'll give you an alert. There is a lot of work went into the visuals of it. So with Alexa integrating APL, right, for these multimodal devices, which was really exciting. I think that's when I really sort of saw what Big Sky could be once I started making it a truly multimodal experience. Yeah. And then there's also a lot of personalization. So I added a feature where you could personalize or label particular locations like mom's house or the boat or right the campground. So you could then ask for weather at the campground or mom's house and get all that information, again, in a very personalized, natural, conversational way. So those are some of the big things that I've added. But every year as these platforms, as Bixby comes along or Alexa adds new features, I'm always excited to try to integrate those into Big Sky and just keep it current.
Yeah, and indeed, it's really an awesome experience. So I certainly use Big Sky on my own Alexa, and I have it set as the default weather capsule on Bixby. So if I ask Bixby, what's the weather? Big Sky answers. It really is a better experience than what's built in. And I really love it's super hyper-local, and I want to know, that's great, it's going to rain in my town, but sometimes that rain is 5 miles away. So it's super helpful and useful. So, Stephen, you did early things, have been working on Big Sky, and that's kind of the champion of your portfolio, I'd probably say.
Right, yeah.
But are there other voice experiences that you're still building or working on or thinking about?
So I have several skills on the Alexa platform. One is not exactly suitable for the family, but I think a fun capsule called Trump Against Humanity, which is sort of a mashup of Cards Against Humanity and Trump tweets reformed into a game, which I think, if you're in the right mood, is super fun. And I have another game called Goats of Fortune, which I don't think anyone has used. Is that true? Maybe one or two people have used. But it's a gamification of what's called the Monty Hall problem. The Monty Hall problem is It comes from Let's Make a Deal. And there's this question when the game show, you pick a door, behind one door is a prize and behind the other two doors is a booby prize. And on the original Let's Make a Deal, Monty Hall would then open a door, show you that it was a booby prize, and then ask you if you wanted to switch doors, right? And there's a question about whether you should stay or switch, which I found the answer is you should always switch. But I found that to be an interesting problem. And so I built an Alexa skill, which is a game sort of that demonstrates the answer to the Monty Hall problem. So that's kind of a fun experience.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You said you built Big Sky for yourself first.
Yes.
And then you build these other ones for yourself first. And I always find that's the best way to go about thinking about, build something you're passionate about it. And then go release it. And sometimes it goes big and sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
But as I've said to people, at least it has one very passionate user.
That's right.
Right? That's yourself. Right. And yeah. I just think it's just a great way to think about what to build is what are you interested in? What are you passionate about? So along those lines, Stephen, you've been in voice development for a long time relative to voice, right? Given one of the, you were an early Alexa skill developer.
Relative to voice, that's right.
Yes, and relative to voice, because it always seems 3 years is an amazing long time in voice, right? Which seems kind of absurd, but it's true. What advice would you have for people who are aspiring voice developers and designers and just jumping into this in general about what they should build or how they should build and what they should think about?
Yeah, so I think the advice you just gave is perfect. They should try to build something that they're passionate about, something that they're interested in. And I think probably the best voice experience is begin with a sense that there's something that you want the device to do that it doesn't do. So in a way, right, there has to be a real need for it. It really should be able to do this. Why can't it do that? And then try to build that. And then, of course, you have to think about whether voice is the right use case for it. So, for example, in the weather skill or the home automation or the music skill, I thought all of those were really good cases for voice where there was some very specific thing you wanted to know, and it just wouldn't take forever, but it would take a little while to dig out the phone and open the app and scroll through the options. And whenever you think, well, actually, I don't want to do it because, although it's not that hard, but it would take a little bit to get this going on the phone, I think that's like a perfect case for voice. So start with some need, some problem that needs to be solved, figure out whether that use case is really fit to voice. And I think those are two great places to start.
Yeah, so spot on around look where there's some friction. As you said,
yeah.
Gosh, I got to pull my phone out. I got to unlock it. I got to scroll. I got to tap. I got to find the app. Whenever I see something like with an app or even on the desktop, I'm like, wow, there's probably an opportunity for voice there. Conversely, if it's easier to do by swiping or typing or using your mouse, probably not a great idea for voice. You got to think of where is there friction and where voice is the best modality to actually go and accomplish that task or have that fun or do whatever you want to do. I think that is so spot on advice.
Yeah.
Stephen, I want to shift gears a little bit and let's talk about your daytime job. You're a professor at Reed College. For those listeners who don't know, Reed is a private university in Portland, Oregon. Not well known, but a very, very good university, and it's really well respected. Tell me about your work at Reed as a professor. What do you teach?
Yeah, so my primary research focus and teaching focus has been on ethics. That's what all of my publications are in. I always tell people it's not the most useful area of ethics because it doesn't really focus on whether you should do particular things or whether particular kinds of acts are right or wrong. But and perhaps as you expect from an academic, it's more abstract than that. It's sort of about the nature of ethics. What do ethical statements mean? What are the nature of ethical properties? How are we to understand what ethical truth is? Things that are sort of more abstract in general, and they don't have any or very many sort of direct implications about whether you should eat meat or whether there should be a private market for, you know, blood or something like that. But yeah, so generally the area is called metaethics, and I've been teaching there for about 20 years now. Yeah,
so that's,
I'm ensconced.
Ah, got it. So can I take an example? Maybe you could break that down, because you mentioned about whether you should eat meat, right?
Yeah.
There's strong opinions on both sides, you know, whether you should or should not. And it comes up to kind of often an ethical question. How would you see that? How would you break that down in your study?
Yeah. So again, from my perspective, I mean, I do find it an interesting question on its right on its own. And but in terms of my research interests, I mean, I would be interested in questions like, well, how are we to understand the should? Like, what does it mean to say one should or shouldn't eat meat? And in particular, I'm very interested in the intersection between morality and psychology. Right. And there's this general idea that if it's true that you should or shouldn't do a particular thing, and that should is a moral should, then there in some way you have to be able to be moved or motivated to act in accordance with the ethical claim. And so my interest is really in how do we bridge that divide, or is there a way to bridge that divide such that if it's true that you should or shouldn't do a certain thing, should or shouldn't eat meat, then once you understand that truth and understand why it's true, then what is it about us or about the moral domain that allows us to be motivated and to act, right, on those concerns? It's super easy to understand how that happens if the should or shouldn't applies to your self-interest. Right. So if I say you should invest in this and you really want to invest, right, you really want money, then once you understand why you should invest in it, then it's easy to see how you're motivated to put your money there. But let's say you eat meat and you're like me, perhaps you eat meat, but you think you shouldn't really. That's my view. I eat meat, but I'm pretty convinced that I shouldn't. Right. Then there is sort of this gap between understanding the truth of the ethical claim and being motivated or moved or acting on the reasons that you think you have to act in accordance with the ethical claim. And sort of right in that area is my sort of my research interest. How are we to understand that relationship?
Interesting. Yeah. So there's a belief, but you're also looking at the behavior.
Yeah.
And the connection between the two, right, or disconnect, right? I would share with you, I eat meat, but I actually believe I shouldn't. But there's some reason why I don't follow. So I believe in something, but my behavior belies my belief.
Yes, right? That's right. Somehow your desires don't automatically align with your beliefs in the way that they align with beliefs about, let's say, things that are in your self-interest or in the interest of people you love or something like that. And so a lot of people have found, and I think this is true, that that fact says something very important about what the nature of ethical statements is, what they mean, or sort of what ethical properties are, because there is this disconnect, right? So some people have made this argument that because there's this disconnect between coming to believe the truth of an ethical statement and being appropriately motivated, somehow ethical statements aren't matters of fact in the way that other kinds of scientific statements are matters of fact, right? So anyway, once you have this phenomenon of this disconnect, some people think that that must shed some light on what the nature of ethical discourse is, because you don't have that disconnect in other domains.
This is fascinating. We could probably talk about this for a while.
Yes,
actually.
Right, but it's probably getting far away from voice.
And yeah, voice. Yeah. I have a degree in psychology, and I also think about how anthropology and culture fits in and impacts this. And we're getting far away from voice, but absolutely fascinating.
But you asked the question, so I...
Ah, perfect. Perfect. Right. I'm the guilty one.
You're the guilty one. That's right.
So speaking of that, I happened to look you up on LinkedIn, and I noticed you got your graduate degree from Berkeley.
Yes.
And so go Bears.
A graduate.
Yeah, Berkeley. Like I said, degree in psychology. And I think while you were getting a graduate degree, we overlapped a bit. I took my time getting my undergraduate degree, which is a whole other story in and of itself.
Yeah, well, I took my time getting my graduate degree. So
there we go. All right. All right. So all fair. So you're a voice developer, but you're also this professor of philosophy. Do you see the worlds intersecting? Where do you see voice in education or in higher education? I guess I should ask.
Yeah. So hopefully I see them intersecting, at least for me on the research side. I'm hoping to try to bring these two passions together in some kind of research project. But in terms of voice in higher education, yeah, that's an interesting question. I should have a better answer because people ask me about it a lot, given my sort of two interests. In the classroom, I personally, although it could just be lack of imagination, don't see so much use in higher education for voice in a college classroom. But in college life, I actually see that it could be incredibly useful. For example, in the college dorm room, I would think that a voice assistant, certain capsules where students can ask about their schedule, they can ask about where they are on like the wait list if they're registering, they could ask like what's at the commons for lunch if they're trying to think about getting out of bed in time to go to lunch. They might just, right, want to know, like, are they serving the vegan grilled cheese, in which case I'm going to sleep, or are they serving something really good, in which case I'll, you know, leave my dorm room today. So I could imagine all kinds of great use cases for voice assistants, like in college culture, in the dorm room. Yeah, I'm surprised. Maybe it actually is happening and I don't know about it, but it just seems like such an obvious fit.
You know, I've read a few things about that. Some universities have, was it Arizona or Arizona State, was giving Alexas to all their incoming freshmen with that kind of general information. And it was a great big experiment to go and see, hey, just as student information, right? If you go and you can ask your voice assistant, that's probably, talk about friction, lowest, easiest way, what's the dorm lunch menu? Go ask your voice assistant and answers that. That's truly a low friction way of doing it. But it's interesting to think about how voice, and I think about in education in many other ways, where we can bring it in, you have this device. Now, how we can enable it to just enable us, frankly, to live just happier, better lives and just get our information quicker and faster. We're deluged with information, but sometimes I really need a specific piece. And one of the things I really love about voice is it can be very direct and to the point. I just want this information. I don't need to be inundated with 12 other pieces of information.
Right.
I'll spend 30 minutes looking up the lunch menu when it's a 30-second answer because I got distracted by my phone or a browser or Twitter feed, you name it. Right.
Yeah. I mean, nobody is going to open up their laptop, go to the college website, try to find, I don't even know where I would find like online what's being served for lunch at, you know, at Recall. I have no idea. It's somewhere, I'm sure, on the, but no one's going to do that. So just being able to ask what's for lunch is great. But then in terms of what I provide to students at the college, I don't yet see, hopefully I don't see a voice assistant being able to give like lectures in philosophy. Right. Or answer questions on philosophy exams, like does the soul exist? I don't see that happening yet. But in terms of things like student advising or filling out a schedule, right there. And again, this actually could be a more conversational moment for voice to come in where there would be a lot of more back and forth. But still, the options are quite constrained. I can look at, I know the rules for signing up for classes or what the requirements are for the major. They're not that many. And so often when the student comes in and we talk about it, we have this conversation, but I realize there's really 12 rules here. You could do this just as well as I can. And I think a voice assistant, maybe going forward, that would be a really good use case for a voice assistant, where it's not just one specific piece of information. It would have to be more complicated. It would have to be a conversation. But still, it seems like it should be doable, and it would be a great way for it to assist in those kinds of tasks.
Yeah, you know, sometimes voice resonates in a way that what's written doesn't, right? And just sometimes as an individual person, I have a daughter who is, well, I'll say was, because she's recently been reading a lot, but was not a good reader. But if you speak to her and talk to her, it just clicks immediately. But she can read it and doesn't get it. Probably less of an issue at the higher education level. But I still think sometimes people hearing something will resonate or they'll remember it in a different way than actually reading it. And it kind of augments that information, provides a different way that's either more convenient or just in a way that for that individual resonates and connects with them in a better way.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think there is something about the conversation. And I think about this a lot when I'm doing student advising, where it's just helpful to have the information spoken to. It's helpful to have a couple options presented. And again, I think this would be it might be a little bit beyond voice right now, but I could certainly see it not being beyond voice in a year or two or 3 years, where the voice assistant can then, in a conversational way, say, these are your options, guide you through them, answer some follow-up questions about it, reassure you that this is going to actually meet all the requirements. Because sometimes what you would want is just reassurance. Like, I've read the rules. They're not that complicated, but there's like seven of them. So I really just need somebody to tell me, yes, that's, if you do this, for example, you'll graduate on time. I think that would be maybe not at the final step, but as an initial step for a voice assistant to be able to do that. That would be great.
Yeah, lots of opportunities. Hey, I want to shift gears a little bit and get back to technology. So you've been building Alexa skills since the very, very early days, but more recently you brought Big Sky to Bixby. What was your experience with Bixby been like so far?
It's just been great. I don't want to sound obsequious, but it's true. My developer experience with Bixby has been great. The development tools are just kind of a joy to work with. They're super polished and developer friendly. And early on, I was a Bixby Premier developer, so I got some sort of nice kind of white glove treatment to walk me through the initial stages. So that was great. So I think I found building for Bixby, although there was a bit of a paradigm shift for sure, you definitely have to change to this idea that you're kind of modeling the information as opposed to writing a lot of declarative code. But once you make that shift, it's very natural. And yeah, I really enjoy doing it. In fact, I have to go back because I'm getting deprecation warnings now. So I have to go back and update things. And I'm really looking forward to going back into Bixby Studio and working. It's fun. It's kind of like a playground in there. It's great.
Oh, well, very nice to hear. Speaking about Bixby, it's on the phone right now, but it's coming to TV watches. Well, actually, you can deploy to watches right now, just recently announced, and smart appliances this year. What do these devices get you most excited?
Well, in terms of Big Sky in particular, I think watches, and actually the refrigerators is also another really good use case for weather. But I think watches, getting weather on the go when you're out running and you want, and it's starting to look a little ominous and you want to know if it's right. How long until it's going to rain? Do I have a half hour left on this run? There is a case where in the middle of the run, you are not going to pull out your phone or even open up the watch the small watch interface to try to get this little piece of information. So I think that's a great use case for voice. And also just the refrigerator, you're up. The first thing you do in the morning might be open the refrigerator, get some orange juice or some milk. If you saw the weather forecast right there without even having to speak anything, that would be, I think those are both great use cases. So I'm really excited about those things.
Yeah, it's interesting of the watch because I've been playing with and developing with it. In watch apps today, whether it's Samsung watches or Apple watches, they work, but there's a lot of, you're swiping on this tiny little like 1-inch screen. And boy, that doesn't feel very natural. It feels to me like the real natural interface for that screen has got to be voice. And so I get really excited because I think it's a modality that we haven't figured out a really great way of interfacing with. And hopefully voice will be kind of an unlock to go, I talk to it mostly, but I'm going to use that, you know, very small UI, but I'm going to use that in a way that kind of augments or works together with what I'm actually talking with the device about. I think there's a lot of interesting things to be built there, so to speak.
Yes, I absolutely agree. So I'm really excited to get going and bring Big Sky to the watch. That's one of my top priorities in the next few weeks.
Awesome. Well, look forward to it. How about for voice in general? What else are you excited about? What would you like to see happen in the voice industry in, I'll say, the near term, next year or so? What's happening that's getting you excited? Or what would you like to see happen that would get you excited in the short term?
Yeah, well, in the short term or medium short term, going back to some of these things we talked about, I really would like to see voice become more conversational. Although we started talking about an obvious use case for voice is where you just want a particular piece of information and don't want to hunt through a website to find it. Again, there's other cases where it would be so much better if in an extended interaction with an assistant, that felt more natural, more conversational, less like a phone tree. And I know Samsung is working on this and Alexa is working on this. Amazon is working on this, you know, trying to implement the things that are required to get that to happen, like much more sophisticated context carryover, right? Much more sophisticated understanding of what the context is. I really think that is the next thing that needs to happen. And I see people are working hard on getting it to happen in the next year or two or three. I think that would be, that's what I'm really, really excited about.
Yes, it moved beyond what I call the kind of bark command stage we're at right now. Bark a command, the voice assistant does something, get to where it actually is conversational and you can actually have a back and forth. Because let's face it, right now, in any of the voices, that's pretty darn limited.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that both of those things are great cases, right? So the bark command is, it's perfect for voice. It really is. But then so is this other thing. And so we just need them. We need them both.
Absolutely. No. Barking commands is not going to go away. It's kind of the natural thing. What's home automation? Barking commands.
Yeah, that's right.
And what's a lot of playing music, right? I want to listen to this music by this artist, and I want to listen to the live version from this concert. Well, that's a perfect voice UI, but you're really saying, go start it and then get out of the way and let me enjoy my music. And that's barking command. So nothing wrong with that. It's just kind of the state of where it is right now. How about project further? 5, 10 years. Where do you see voice going then?
Boy, that's a tougher one. I definitely see it being more pervasive. I think that is the one thing that I assume is going to happen. That sometimes voice is referred to as ambient computing. And I think that's what's going to happen. That voice will be everywhere and it will be interconnected with all kinds of modalities and devices. So computing will just, as it were, be in the air, will just be able to speak almost anywhere to anything at any time, right? And things will happen. Like there's no reason why I couldn't be just in my car, right? And just say, preheat the oven for this thing, and then I'll be out on the run and just be able to say, actually change that to 300 degrees, right? And the context carryover will be there. And so whatever device I'm talking about will know that in the car I set a temperature and that I can hear I'm talking. So I think that's going to be the future of voice. I hope that will get to us in the next 5 or 10 years. Yeah.
Yeah. I like to think of kind of ambient computing as kind of almost deviceless computing in a sense that I don't have to worry about where the device is or what device it is. I just ask and something.
That's right.
Something takes care of it for me. Right. And I think right now we're still worrying about what device is or where it is. And I think voice is kind of a preview to kind of ambient, just say something and a device somewhere takes care of it. But truly deviceless is I could just talk and have something happen. And deviceless, locationless, wherever I am, I can make something happen and it works. Yeah, that will be very cool. And I get excited when technology empowers us and unburdens us and makes it easy to enjoy life and have some things happen. So yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I share your excitement for that future. So one question I always like to ask before wrapping up is, Stephen, you built some really great voice experiences. Big Sky is probably one of the most well-known voice experiences out there. So aside from your own, what are a couple other voice experiences that you really enjoy?
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. So the one that I probably use the most is Sleep Sounds, Invoked Apps. I use that not quite every night, but I think more and more lately. So that's one, I mean, that's another great case for voice, but I use that all the time. I really like Song Quiz. Me and the kids have had a lot of fun doing Song Quiz, which is on Alexa and Bixby at this point. Is that
coming to Bixby, I believe.
Bixby. Okay. Yeah. So Song Quiz is great. And Question of the Day. These are this another skill that me or the kids just, while we're in the kitchen, right, just trying to fill up a little bit of time with a fun thing to do. So those are three skills that I think I use frequently and really enjoy.
So when you use Song Quiz with your kids, do you find a large generational gap like I do in music knowledge?
Yeah, no, I make them take the quiz from, this is how it happens, is either we'll pick the 80s or 90s, in which case I get them all and they get none. Or they do 2010s, right? And then they get them all and I get none. That's just the way it works.
Yeah, it's a reminder of everything we all always know. And then they're like, they're kind of astonished that I don't know who X is. And I'm sorry. But likewise, I'm astonished that you don't know who Y is.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? How could you not know?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. How do you not know who Jethro Tull is? Right?
Yes.
To pull out somebody from the 70s. Hey, Stephen. So if people want to keep in contact with you, what's the best way to do so?
Well, you could reach me on Twitter, at Sarkanovich is my Twitter handle. And you can also reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm just Stephen Arkanovich on LinkedIn.
Perfect. And I will definitely put those in the show notes. So, Stephen, really, really a pleasure talking to you. I'm a fan. Like I said, love Big Sky. And was excited to talk to you just about how, frankly, a college professor of philosophy who doesn't fit maybe our stereotypes of an amazing voice developer, came and built something that has been so successful in voice. So really, really appreciate your time today. It's really been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Stephen. That's all, folks. Till next time, this is Roger Kibbe of the Bixby Developers Chat podcast, signing off.